Welcome. You're listening to Women's Health and Beyond with Dr. David Goslin, the only podcast for women providing a physician's point of view on everything relating to women's health, sexual medicine, and cosmetic gynecology. Get ready to discover the latest and hottest topics in women's health and how they relate to you.
Hey everyone, this is Dr. David Goslin with Women's Health and Beyond podcast. Today we have Sue Lim with us. She's a psychotherapist. I mean, her background is so eclectic and rich in academia and world experience. I'm going to let her talk a little bit about herself, but she's going to focus today on something, especially during these times, is so important. Aside from being a psychotherapist and a specialist in stress management, she's also a specialist in sleep. And she's going to give us some cues on how we can improve our sleep and perhaps talk about some sleeping techniques. But on that note, I'd like to welcome Sue to the show. Welcome, Sue.
Thanks so much for having me on, David. I'm very happy to be here today. And as you said, I think sleep is such a huge issue right now with what's going on. So,
oh my God, especially, you know, for my listeners out there, we're doing this virtually via Zoom because of the pandemic, and all our stresses are so high because it's November 4th and we're all on pins and needles waiting for the election results to occur.
Yeah, absolutely. And I've had a number of friends reach out today to say they barely slept. And I think it's understandable given it's the day after the election. So
I know. We all stayed up past well past our bedtime. Yeah. Sue, tell me a little bit about you and where you come from. And I know you've lived in different countries and done so many interesting things. And so I think it's going to help us really understand where you are today and why you chose this.
Absolutely. Well, as you can probably tell from my accent, I grew up in England. But you may be able to also tell from my name, Sue Lim, that I'm Chinese, and I was actually born in Southeast Asia. I spent the first few years of my life in Malaysia, but my dad got a job in London, so we moved there. And I grew up in England, and that's where actually I got my law degree, and I didn't end up practicing because I got pulled into the world of entertainment. I actually, a week after getting the top law prize at London University, I was actually making tea on a film set, which was fun and very different, and no one could believe it. But
amazing. You know,
it kept me in the entertainment business for a long time, both on set, and then I became an executive. And I worked for a German film finance company based here in LA, which is where I moved to in my mid-20s. So, you know, that was, you know, for me, moving here seemed like an essential part of, you know, my professional life, obviously, with Hollywood. But, you know, there were some challenges for me because in the end, what I care more about is the story of people. And I think that's what drew me to the film business. And really, I think what I do now as a therapist is real life stories. And so for the past 10 years, I retrained and ended up, you know, doing this, this career, and I love it. You know, I have a private practice, and I think it's the most fulfilling thing I've done, and what I'll do from now on, in spite of my eclectic background before, I'm here to stay.
Well, that's wonderful to hear, because I'm sure we're all delighted you're staying in therapy. Tell us a little bit, I mean, you've done more, you know, you've gone beyond just getting a therapy degree. You actually got your master's, and you've been certified in some very interesting niches of therapy. You want to go into that a little bit?
Sure, yes. My main specialty is anxiety and stress management. And again, I feel that having spent so long in the entertainment business, I know that particular brand of anxiety and the sense that you have to live up to certain expectations you might have for yourself. Yet it's an incredibly challenging field. So I have a lot of entertainment clients, but I also come from a very professional background in terms of, you know, having got my law degree, for instance. And that's because there were a lot of lawyers and doctors and bankers in my family back in Malaysia as well as in England. So I also have an understanding of those kinds of pressures, of that sort of white collar, intense, highly stressful career.
Absolutely. And we're seeing that all the time. And I think probably you'd agree with me, Sue, that it's been augmented during these crazy times.
Absolutely, yes. With the pandemic, you know, I've obviously had to deal with clients suffering, you know, furloughs and job losses, as well as, some actually, obviously the ones in tech and certain areas, they benefited, but the amount of guilt that comes with them thriving and seeing, you know, the rest of the country really struggle, it's been tough. And again, it's that reassessment this past year of how can you cope? You know, what career could you turn to if where you've been going is no longer working, for instance, for you?
Well, you know, we have so much to talk about, and I really want to get into sleep therapy, which I know is one of your specialties. But before we go into sleep therapy, I mean, you have so much knowledge. Can you give us a few minutes of pearls and cues that my audience can use in order to maybe help alleviate some of these stresses that people are going through, both financially, emotionally, relationship-wise during these times?
I would say patience and being kind to yourself, and also trying not to fast forward in your thinking every day. There's so much of this sense of when the pandemic is over, when there's a vaccine, when you can go back to work, when you can see your friends again. It's incredibly stressful, and I think it adds an extra layer to the very natural anxieties everyone's going through anyway. So I think I would say trying to stay very present and just seeing that today is all you have, really. And if you are only wishing for tomorrow and always going what if or when, you're really missing a lot of your life, because we don't know when all this is going to be over.
I love that. So don't abuse yourself. Be kind to yourself. Think in the present. Stay in the present. And you should get through this.
Yes. I mean, you know, it's not easy. But I think that's, one way to just try and refocus yourself and to know that, you know, wishing isn't going to make it come any faster.
And great points. And I think one of the things that really helps us get through these difficult times is a good night's sleep. Because if you don't have it, it really wreaks havoc on your body, mentally, physically, emotionally. So I'd love to talk about what you're doing in this area and how you help people and how we can learn from you.
Absolutely. So, just as a preamble, I trained in CBTI, which is cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia, initially because I also had sleep issues once. At the end of my marriage, there were some very challenging events that threw me almost into instant insomnia. And this was back in England when I was working still in film, actually. So consequently, my doctor then insisted I try to go on Ambien. So I used Ambien for a number of years, and, you know, I used half doses. It wasn't every night, but I became reliant. I don't mean addicted kind of reliant, but I didn't dare go to sleep without it. I also switched to melatonin sometimes, and it became this situation where I kept thinking, I've got to be able to sleep. And so when I came across CBTI, I was a therapist by then. I decided, well, let me look more into it. And I found it so effective. I looked into it, I trained in it, I was my first patient and it worked. So, you know, I'm a true believer. And for me, you know, it's just such a relief not to have to go to bed worrying and thinking and dreading anymore, or waking up in the middle of the night and thinking it's more than it is.
Of course.
Sorry, go on.
No, I said, of course. So Sue, to us lay people, what is cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia? What's the principal basis of this?
Yes. Ultimately, it's the belief that insomnia comes from negative sleep thoughts and negative sleep behaviors. So CBTI, It's been endorsed by the National Institutes for Health as the most effective method for treating insomnia. It's longer lasting, it's more effective, and it's a much safer solution, obviously, than sleeping pills. Research has been done, and about 85-90% of people who've gone through CBTI have either been able to cut down or totally cut out sleep meds. And 75% have actually been able to report that they have better sleep after this treatment. It's a treatment essentially of 5 sessions over the course of 6 weeks, but it obviously can vary depending on how long you've had issues with sleep. I've had clients sometimes come for 2 months to really tackle problems that may have gone back decades. And some have continued to stay on to work through other issues like anxiety and other things going on in their life that have ended up causing insomnia. But for them, you know, it was something that they just wanted to work through even after their sleep issues were resolved.
So Sue, when you're first doing a consultation with a potential client, are you trying to figure out what presently is acting negatively, or are you focusing on the past?
It's both, really. I start with the present, and I get a big, I take a lot of information about their sleep patterns, what they do, as well as what might be going on in their lives. For me, I can just focus on sleep. So some of them already have therapists, and that's totally fine. And I just deal with the insomnia within, you know, the 6, 8, however many weeks. So it's, you know, sometimes if they haven't got a therapist already, we'll look a little bit more into the history of how it started and what emotional or mental health issues may have contributed to their sleep problems.
And when you say that you have a protocol of 5 to 6 sessions, is that because each session you have a purpose that you're trying to meet? For example, the first session maybe is discovery, and the second session is starting to work on techniques of trying to relax your mind. I'm just trying, or is it purely therapeutic, therapy driven the entire time?
No, actually, it's a certain protocol. This was developed at Harvard Medical School. And that's the training I got, a CBTI course that was developed there over a number of decades. And so it's actually broken up into, you know, each week we work on different issues, the sleep hygiene, if there has been reliance on pills, then we work on reducing that.
And how do you do that? So if I'm taking Ambien every night to fall asleep, it's not easy to just stop cold turkey.
Right, and it's not safe either, as you know. You know, especially if it's something like benzos, or it's something that people have been using in high doses over a long period of time. So I have to take all that into account. Effectively, and this is something I talk to clients about, so it's very specific to the client, but effectively, we cut down half doses when they feel comfortable, because it's very important that they feel at ease with this process and it doesn't become something that's traumatizing, especially if there's a lot of negative thinking associated with lack of sleep. So sure. We'll cut down the dose twice a week and then every other day. But again, this is something that, you know, it's very specific to the clients, but effectively it's titrating down so that eventually they get to a point, if that's what they choose, to be off medication totally. And of course, it's a important thing to be off pills, because there are so many negative aspects, as you know. And in fact, there's a placebo effect. I'm not saying pills aren't effective, but many people fall asleep even before the sleep meds have been absorbed into the GI tract. So it's just this feeling that they need it. And something like Ambien, which, you know, I'm aware of, and a lot of my clients actually say this, it helps them fall asleep, and they're asleep for about 3-4 hours, and then they're up anyway. It just doesn't last. Even the Ambien CR version, which is the slow release version, it doesn't really take you to the whole night for most
people. No, and it makes you groggy.
And it makes you groggy. Exactly. You have the half-life issues, and all the other dangers, you know, addiction, there's possible abuse, there's the tolerance, you know, you have to keep upping your dose, which is terrible. The half-life, as you mentioned, you know, are you going to be safe to drive the next day? The elderly who take pills, you know, they might fall. Mixing with other meds.
Mixing medications is very dangerous.
Yeah.
So Sue, what kind of tools are you giving them? I'm assuming, and I don't know anything about this, so really this is off the cuff, but I'm assuming you're teaching them and giving them the tools to be able to fall asleep all the while not having that medication or decreasing the dosing. So what kind of tools are you instructing them? Are you giving them meditational tools? How does it work?
Yes. Well, we can talk about meditation later because I think that's really important. But in the first session, for instance, I tell them about the physiology of sleep. We go through the different stages of sleep and what matters most, the deep sleep and the REM sleep. And the fact that light sleep, which is 50% of your sleep cycle, which is about 90 minutes, light sleep is a huge part of sleep, but a lot of people who complain that they don't sleep well actually spending their time asleep when they don't believe they are. And yet light sleep is an important feature. So what we do is we'll talk about what sleep means. As I said, it's the different stages. It's, you know, what about how much sleep they really need. For instance, core sleep. And this is a very important fact that clients have told me has really helped them. Core sleep is actually 5.5 hours only. So when everyone talks about needing 8 hours sleep and that's the optimum number of hours, it actually isn't. And I'm not advocating, obviously, that everyone should only sleep 5.5 hours, but part of dealing with the thoughts and behaviors around insomnia is not panicking, not dreading, not imagining that you are doing something harmful to your body. And you can survive on 5.5 hours. You know, doctors in residency, firefighters, even these long distance solo transatlantic, you know, yacht races, it's been tested. You can manage for a good amount of time on just 5.5. And something that's also interesting, considering, you know, every newspaper article you read says that you've got to have 8 hours or it's detrimental to your health. It's about, there have been about over 50 studies at this point with millions of volunteers over the past decade and a half that shows that the lowest mortality rate is actually linked to 7 hours of sleep. So when you think about it, that's only 1.5 hours more than the basic 5.5 hours of core sleep that your body needs. So there's actually an increased risk of death when you sleep more than 7 hours versus if you sleep fewer than 7 hours.
That's interesting.
Yeah. And it's something that, you know, as I said, it's been proved in a lot of research at this point. And I also think it's interesting, if you know Lumosity, that brain training app, they did substantial research on sleep and brain functioning on about 500,000 volunteers between, I think it's 15 and about 70, 75 years of age. And they found that performance levels for all of the age groups was best at just 7 hours of sleep. So again, either more or less than seven had decreased cognitive performance levels. So I think that, you know, what I help clients with is understanding that, you know, if it's 6 or 7 hours a night, ultimately, if you can function the next day, and what we work on is positive sleep thoughts, which I'll get into a little later, that it's really not that much more than the core sleep you need of 5.5 hours. And also that seven is optimal anyway. And basically just to accept that it's okay, that, you know, part of the positive sleep thoughts that I help them with is to understand that, you know, that generally their performance does not affect them that significantly the next day. It's more mood and irritability, as well as the concern, the awareness that you didn't sleep enough can sometimes drive you into a state more than lack of functioning.
And I would also assume that the criteria around which you're sleeping, for example, if you're taking an Ambien and you're sleeping 7 hours, it's not the same as if you went to bed, meditated, and slept 7 hours.
Right. Exactly.
So you have to take that into consideration.
Yeah. You know, it's not as restful. Just like people, let's say, who take alcohol to try and sleep. Obviously, that's a bad idea in so many ways, but you think it'll help them pass out and get them through the night. But you don't really get your deep or REM sleep in the same way. It ends up being lighter sleep, plus, you know, metabolizes in your body as you sleep. So you have kind of like mild withdrawal moments through the night, which eventually, you know, it's just a lighter level of sleep, just like it doesn't feel as satisfying as if you did it off your own steam, basically.
So can you give us some of your pearls on how we can help improve our sleep if we're not using Ambien?
Yes, in no particular order. It's a good idea not to spend more time in bed, not much more time than you're spending actually asleep in bed. And it's called sleep efficiency. Basically, you want to be able to spend, in the end, about an hour in bed in total between going to bed and waking up over the amount of time you're actually asleep. And I know you have to end up estimating it, because another big no-no is checking your watch or clock, because that's only going to make your brain click into gear again. And
which we all do.
Yes, exactly. It's not a good idea, but we all do. So ideally, you want a sleep efficiency ratio, like good sleepers would have maybe a 90% sleep efficiency ratio. And again, just talking about it, let's say you spend 8 hours in bed and you only sleep six, that's a 75% sleep efficiency. And the thing about CBTI is helping you not associate the bed negatively. It needs to be a positive cue for sleep. So it's important that you don't go to bed until you're tired. And again, this may sound counterintuitive, and you may think, especially if you have sleep problems, it's like, oh my God, I'm going to go to bed at 9 because I slept so badly last night. And then you end up maybe not falling asleep till, let's say, 11:30 or 12. And the time you've spent tossing and turning and restless and unhappy, it compounds that sleep problem you have, because then you'd have the dread and your mind is turning over. So I would say that, especially while you're trying to tackle your sleep problems first, don't go to bed till you're sleepy. Even if it's 1 and you know you have to get up for work and it sounds crazy, you're trying to break the back of something that has become chronic. So I work with clients with sleep journals every week when they come in, and we kind of whittle it down so that eventually it becomes a feasible sleep schedule that works for, you know, that individual.
That's so interesting, because you really basically broke my rule, which is if I had a rough night because I was working in the hospital, I want to try and get to bed by 8 o'clock. And you're so right. There's so many times I'll go and lay down at 8 and I'll end up tossing and turning and getting frustrated. And it's 11 o'clock now, and I'm so stressed and about it that I end up taking an Ambien after all.
Yeah, exactly. So it doesn't work. Plus, it's important to keep, and I know that's difficult for people in your profession, but if possible, to try and keep to the same bedtime, more or less, and waking up time. And again, I know that can be complicated, because especially if you've had a hard week at work and you feel you haven't slept, you just want to lie in on a Saturday morning or a Sunday morning. I would say I get it. And if you can limit that to maybe half an hour, absolute max 1 hour, that's much more helpful, because you really need to keep to the same sleep times. And you can tell just from the clocks having changed recently, it throws you off completely, just that 1 hour. So it's not healthy for your body to have all that kind of variation.
Absolutely. So what's the end goal? So you take them during these sessions, and by the time they're done with their protocol 6-week session with you, people should be able to have the tools so they can fall asleep on a regular basis, get their 7 hours, not have multiple wake up intervals during the night. And you're saying you're getting about a 75 to 85% success rate?
That's actually the research which says that I have a much higher percentage, really, of the
people. Of course you do.
Of course I do. but officially, yes, formally it's 75%. But I find that I think because I'm just very encouraging and I'm very reassuring, and you know, it's real because I do believe in it. You know, I'm not trying to persuade anyone about something that either I don't believe in or that isn't factual. So, you know, there's a lot of trust when I work with someone new, and it does work. And then there's something else that's also important to point out that I also help clients through, which is if you can't sleep in the middle of the night, which is sleep maintenance insomnia versus sleep onset insomnia, to go out after about half an hour, again, not looking at your clock, but just estimating that if you wake up in the middle of the night and you've been tossing and turning and getting restless up to about half an hour and you're not falling back asleep, remove yourself from the bedroom and go and do something quiet outside in the living room. You can meditate, or you can just have your lights dimmed and you can read a book, not screens, you know, not a Kindle or your phone, because again, you don't want that blue light, but you can just have quiet time. And again, you estimate about half an hour and then you go back to bed. And going back to my clients, there's a lot of dread about this. You know, either it's cozy to stay in bed, or they don't want to wake a partner, or they're just reluctant and they don't see how it can work. But that is one of the most helpful tenets of CBTI. And it is.
That's so interesting, Sue, because I think, at least for me, and sometimes I think we all go through moments where we have some insomnia, and I'll do that once in a blue moon where I'll have a really difficult night. And if I get up, I'm almost so angry at myself. I get so stressed because I'm so concerned that I'm not going to be functioning at my best the next day, that I really become negative.
Yes, and I think it's really easy to get to that place, as opposed to a kind of acceptance. It's a little bit like what you were asking me earlier about, we're really going through hell in the world right now with the pandemic, et cetera, et cetera. So I think it's that level of acceptance. It's, this is where I'm at right now. And I always tell my clients, you know, whatever I'm working with them on, whether it's anxiety or relationship issues, any of those things, as well as insomnia, it's only for right now. And so removing yourself from the bedroom, going outside, you're trying to change something that's become chronic. And even that sense of resentment, you can always turn it to being something that's, you know, almost peaceful and enjoyable. It's like, who else is up at 2 or 3? You may as well enjoy the silence and, you know.
You're right. Well, you said it best, be kind to yourself. And I think that applies to every situation.
Yeah.
Not just the pandemic. That's really well taken, and something I've never done before. I'm the one who tosses and turns in bed for 3 hours and refuses to get up. So I'm going to definitely try that. Thank you, Sue. Eddie, tell me a little bit about meditation and what else can, I know I've always heard getting into bedtime habits are super important. I always knew getting into the bed at the same time is very important and helpful, as well as creating habits. What do you recommend as far as routines and bedtime routines?
Well, what's important to know about sleep as well is that your body temperature needs to drop for your body to recognize that it's a cue for sleep. So by doing that, ideally, if you can exercise to raise your body temperature about 3 to 6 hours before your bedtime, that really helps. Even if it's just a walk around the block just to get your heart rate up. And that helps because it takes that amount of time for your body temperature to fall. If you can't do that, a hot bath, more like 2 hours before bed is helpful, especially if you use something like Epsom salts in your bath. And trying to stay in your bath for about half an hour, it's not as effective as exercise, but it's a decent alternative. So it helps in terms of habits before bed as well. You know about, you know, screens, but if you build up your exposure to daylight during the day, then when it gets dark, it also helps you prep for bed, and you dim your lights and just try and get into a kind of a routine where you put your phone away the hour before your bedtime becomes this very peaceful, quiet time if you can. I always tell clients as well, and this doesn't have to be forever, but try and have your bedroom and your bed only be for sleep and sexual activity, because anything else like reading or watching TV is, again, especially while you're trying to crack insomnia, too associated with thinking or with, you know, just it's just too much. And you want it to be that positive cue for sleep. You want to see the bed and to think, this is it. You know, I'm going to really enjoy my sleep.
That makes sense.
So that's two things.
What about foods? Are there any foods or that you recommend?
Yes.
Or stay away from?
Well, I guess the obvious spicy food, for instance, or anything that's going to make you have indigestion or some kind of gassy discomfort. So it's pretty clear the kind of foods you should avoid. Some people have said protein helps, but I don't think so, because I think it can sort of energize you a little bit. So I would disagree, and I'd say a small carb snack can help because it increases your serotonin, which, as you know, is a brain neurotransmitter, which will help sleep. Honey as well helps, because that also produces serotonin.
Yeah. Now, I don't know if you do any of these or recommend, but do you ever recommend essential oils or other alternative ways to relax you?
Yes. I think the lavender is always such a relaxing scent. And there's so many great aromatherapy diffusers these days that you can just put on. And again, even if it's not the middle of the night, just to have that an hour before bed. So that's associated very much with sleep. And I know that you can also find these combinations of oils which are built for sleep, you know, these
yes.
essential oils. And I think those are very soothing as well. I think ylang ylang, is that one? I can't remember, but I've picked up the combinations before. So I think that's good. Obviously something like caffeine. I would say stop all caffeine if you have sleep problems by 9 or 10 in the morning, because it can last more hours than you think. You always think, oh, I'm not going to have it in the afternoon. But some people are very sensitive and they shouldn't have it beyond, you know, first thing in the morning.
And just to point out to the audience, I think, first of all, that's a great idea to stop caffeinated drinks such as coffees or teas. But certain foods have caffeine. So if you're a late night snacker, especially with chocolates and other things, people don't realize that they can have a good amount of caffeine as well.
Yeah. Exactly. No, that's a really valid point. Or even hot cocoa sometimes, you know, rather than soothing, you know, depends on the, you know, the chocolate content in some. It's energizing.
So, I mean, look, obviously sleep is the most important thing we can all do for our well-being. And it's fantastic that you work very closely with this, and your technique seems to be very effective. I want you to tell us a little bit about how we can find you, your practice, and where we can, maybe there's information we can get from the internet or maybe your website. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, absolutely. Well, at the moment I'm working remotely like many therapists in private practice. So, you know, I work on Zoom, FaceTime, if you have an iPhone, or Skype. And a lot of clients have found it actually so effective, and they love not having to commute or park that I think even when I get back into an office, I will probably do a lot of online therapy, because I'm really liking it too. I'm on the West Side. I did have an office in both Westwood and Santa Monica. At the moment, I've suspended it because I'll just get another office on the West Side at some point.
You know, Sue, I'm going to stop you for a second. I think this pandemic has completely changed the way therapists conduct business. That all of my colleagues and friends who are therapists have all told me the same thing, which you just said, which is they are blown away at how effective this online virtual sort of therapy sessions are going for their clients and themselves, that I suspect we're going to see a huge change in this, and probably see a lot of, and I was talking to a friend of mine who just is looking for retail space and came across this building that had 9 therapists in one office location. Ooh. And they're not coming back. They yeah. decided it's much more efficient for their clients and for themselves to work from home.
Yes, and what I never expected was that there's a greater degree of intimacy. I mean, normally my clients are, you know, on the couch, is it? But, you know, my face is really big on a screen and theirs is as well. And there's something that's surprisingly intimate considering it's not face-to-face.
Yeah, well said.
You're liking.
So what is your website or how can people, or your office phone number?
Yes. My website is www.sulimtherapy.com, and that's Sue without an E, just S-U, and it's Lim, L-I-M for Mary. So Sue Lim Therapy. And my phone number is 310-717-0332. And I'd be very happy to hear from anyone who has either sleep issues or wants to work through relationships or anxiety or stress. I think depression and, you know, the issues like depression obviously come up as well. I don't consider it a specialty, but it's something that a lot of clients see me for as well.
Absolutely. Sue, I think you've given us some great tips. Don't forget, be kind to yourself, everyone. That's really, it seems to be the holy grail to everything. And Sue, you know, you have such amazing subspecialties and certifications. We're going to talk, because I'm going to bring you back if you're okay with it. I see that you also do sex therapy. And because I do a lot of sexual medicine, I'd love to have you on the show and focus on sexual medicine and therapy.
Great. Sounds good. Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome, Sue, and I look forward to speaking with you soon.
We hope you enjoyed today's episode of Women's Health and Beyond with Dr. David Goslin. If you found this episode informative, be sure to subscribe to our show on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. If you'd like to ask Dr. Goslin a question, please visit our website at www.davidgoslin.com or connect on all social media platforms at David Goslin. We'll see you next week for another episode.